Today on Wings, Rita Hope Akiro-Lacour, Executive Director of the Uganda Women's Network, tells how her organization works around a variety of blockages that keep women from accessing the land, political effectiveness, and personal safety that by rights should be theirs.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Uganda Women's Network is a nonprofit umbrella for a coalition of women's organizations in Uganda and across East Africa, and it also provides direct services in both rural and urban areas. Its executive director, Rita Hope Akiro-Lacour, has worked in civil society organizing for more than two decades, especially in the areas of social development, gender, and human rights. She also has a background in business administration, finance, and accounting. She was interviewed for Wings by Sheila Dallas Katzman, who herself has worked on society rebuilding issues for the United Nations. The two spoke in a hallway between sessions of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, which accounts for the activity in the background. Here's Rita Hope Akiro-Lacour.
The patriarchy system that makes men dominate society, but also socialization that has made women believe and men treat women that they're not supposed to own land, is because we're patrilineal lineage, where we follow our father's lineage. And in that lineage, the boy child is superior to the girl child, because it's believed that the girl gets eventually married and therefore she can go own land somewhere else. So she doesn't have to own land in her father's place. And yet, even when she gets married, in the other place, she's seen as a foreigner. So the woman or the girl is left in between. You don't belong to your father's side, neither do you belong to your husband's side. Or you can't own land and property on either side. So that is the challenge we have in Uganda. However, as more girls go to school, as more women get exposed, there are women who are now starting to buy land in their own name. There are parents who are now starting to change the mentality that actually even their girl children can own land. So that is gradually changing.
Now, the patriarchy seems to be linked to, in some way, to customary laws. Doesn't customary laws, in a sense, provide for the woman that the woman must be respected, only that it's distorted by this patriarchal system? Can you elaborate on that?
Sheila, you're very right on that. Actually, studies have shown that in the patriarchal society, in the communal society, women's land rights are protected. But that has been distorted by a few greedy leaders in the community. Because when, for example, a woman is married in a community, she's given her portion of land by her father-in-law, as that is where she'll be digging. And in the event, for example, when the husband passes on, the widow is protected and that land continues to be hers. But now a few leaders or elders in the community have distorted that and have started using the same culture and patriarchy to disempower women by taking land away from them. So yes, you're very right. There is a degree, and a very large degree to that extent, that women's land rights were protected under custom. However, that has been distorted by a few.
If they're protected under customary law, and it's law, L-A-W,
yeah,
how can it be distorted? Because doesn't it mean that when the husband dies, it means that the land automatically goes to the woman? Does this mean that she gets title? She gets papers handed over to her with her name on it, and this is what is taken away from her?
Unfortunately, customary land is not titled land in Uganda. There are no documentation to show that this is your land. It is word of mouth. It is trust. So there is no documentation. Although now people are trying to write certain things, but ordinarily, customary land is not titled. And under custom, actually, land is owned by a few people in trust. of others. They hold it on behalf of others. Everybody in the community only has access rights to that land, but not ownership. Because with ownership, you have the right to dispose, you have the right to give away, you have the right to mortgage. But that right to give, mortgage, and dispose cannot happen under custom. Because even the boy child or the man in that home cannot sell customary land. Because then you have to call the entire village, the entire clan, to agree. There is no portioning of land under customary law.
So you have this land thing where maybe the paramount chief is the custodian of the land for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fact?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Yes.
So the paramount chief or whichever chief can decide mm-hmm. whether or not the woman gets a title if she wants, and she never usually gets it from the chief anyways.
Actually, what has happened now, after engaging for over 20 years on these issues of women's land rights, we have realized that we cannot continue advocating for more laws, and more policies in protection of women's land rights, because the laws alone are not helping us anymore. We need to go back to the roots, find out what the problem is. And partly the problem lies with the so-called paramount chiefs, the clan heads, family heads, who are generally men. So now what we're doing is getting these men with their different titles, trying to engage them, train them, give them information, provide them the advantages of women owning land or controlling land. And now we are educating the men to ensure that they become the game changers. They become the people who protect women's land rights and the community.
How do you do that?
We have a lot of engagements with them. We have written small books for them, especially on issues of women's rights and gender equality and the importance of that. We identify them within the communities, who are the leaders in these communities. First of all, we train them on the state law, what the state law requires out of any citizen. Then after we've done that, we take them through the importance of them understanding women's land rights and girls' land rights. And we solicit their support. We do not coerce them. We solicit their support to engage with us in ensuring that women within the community are protected against violation of land rights.
Wouldn't you say, something comes to mind when you're speaking, you know, in a peacekeeping mission, we had to give wind-up radios to different communities returning after, you know, peace negotiations. And UNICEF, I remembered at the time, said, do not give these radios to the paramount chiefs, because it means the women and the children will not have a chance to listen to the radio, because these guys will want to listen to sports. UNICEF said, give the radio to a young girl in the community, and then everybody will have a chance to listen to the radio when the time comes for them to listen to the radio.
I think that is counterproductive. Whether you give it to the young lady or the young man in the community, the paramount chief or the elder has authority over this young person, and they can still remove that radio. So what do you do best? The best you do is give the radio to him. Tell him the importance you're giving the radio to him. Make him understand the reason why they need to apportion the time. We cannot, where we are standing now, we cannot afford to ignore the paramount chiefs, the clan heads, whatever title they call themselves. We cannot afford to ignore them in the name of women's rights. We have to get them on board. Because why am I saying that? They are the root cause. They are the perpetuators. And it is important that we deal with the root cause and not the symptoms.
Wow.
On Wings, you are listening to the Executive Director of the Uganda Women's Network, Rita Hope Akiro-Lacour. Akiro-Lacour had just given a talk at the 2019 UN Commission on the Status of Women gathering in New York. She was then interviewed by Sheila Dallas Katzman.
Now, you also said something in there that some of the women are losing properties because of loans. So you're saying women have access to loan. What group of women have access to loan, not the rural farmer?
Mm-hmm. Actually, studies have shown in Uganda that women who access loans have been able to pay back. They are very faithful. What is challenging is that the men go get the loan and use, for example, the matrimonial property as a collateral. Now, they don't tell the women. Now, that's how property gets lost. Or they use some other property and they are not paying back, then the property gets taken. But studies in Uganda show that women who have taken up loans are very faithful in paying back.
There's something I don't understand, though, about the land situation in your country, Uganda, where you said in the earlier panel that there are no land tax on resident homes.
No.
Seem unheard of.
Of course, the legal regime has been changing. It wasn't there. And there was an attempt to introduce it about three to four years ago. But, of course, the power of the people, people started raising questions about how it's going to happen. We are a low-income country. And for various reasons, our president said, stop it, don't put taxes. But I think that is very temporal. It's a very temporal measure. It's bound to happen.
Do you own your own land?
Yes, I do.
And are you married?
Yes, I am.
And how does that negotiation work out? You have a forward-looking husband?
Yes. When I have a forward-looking husband, we've had an opportunity to come from families that understand that girls' rights and boys' rights are equal. I do own property jointly with my husband. I own property as an individual as well. Just like I can own a pair of shoes, I own my own piece of land.
Right. And you'll make sure girls and boys are treated equally and,
yes,
and that sort of thing.
Yes. I have two sons and I'm trying to make them become the most gender sensitive men that they can be. They are still teenagers. I don't have any daughters, but I have nieces and I try to do my best for my nieces.
You also said in your panel presentation that maybe the government or, you know, special interests who feels that all these NGOs, civil society organizations who are advocating for women's land rights or whatever rights of women are elitist.
Mm. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
That has been used consistently as a defeatist approach on advancing women's rights, because women's rights has been advanced by women who have gone to school, women who can read the law, women who understand the law, women who have been exposed, and they understand that what is happening behind the backyard is not right, and therefore they stand up to speak against the discrimination against women. And in doing that, the powers that be then start using these advantages these women have had, going to school or being exposed, to say that these are bad wives, these are girls who have gone to school, they are not village girls, they are divorcees, they are not married. You know, they label them all sorts of names. And that has been used to counter the support from the rural women, to counter the support from what I would call the less exposed women. These women might not be exposed, but they have their level of knowledge. They have their level of empowerment. They just need some a little bit of catalyzing to take action. So once they use the educated women against the less exposed women, then they know their support base for the issue definitely collapses.
You know what I have found in countries where illiteracy is rampant is that the market women, for instance, a lot of whom are illiterate or semi-literate, are the most powerful of advocates for rights. Because once you can go and speak to them and educate them about what's right, they can walk with you side by side and they can be a voice in your organization. Are you taking that into consideration?
That is the current approach we have. For us to be able to sustain the work on women's rights, that is the only thing that is going to work. You need to build a fluid social movement. It cannot You cannot sustain women's rights work around a few individuals, a few organizations. There has to be a mass movement, and there has to be women from all categories. And for me, what you said is the in thing.
Can you share with us, you said that your country mm-hmm. has ratified all the international human rights instruments there are mm-hmm. for women's rights and children's rights. Mm-hmm. But that's one thing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Moving that, giving that feet mm-hmm. to run is not happening, mm-hmm. right? Can you share with us some of those mechanisms that you were talking about that you put in place for land rights, for domestic violence, for whatever?
The approach that we're using now is what we call active citizenship, building conscientization. You conscientize the people, not just awareness creation, but raise their consciousness. Let them know that what they have is not the best. Let them know that the leaders that are in place are to service them and not the reverse. Let them know that they deserve better. And if they do know that, then they will demand for what is better. They will have the leaders that will give them better. So raising that awareness or conscientizing them, making the citizens more active into the governance processes, then will lead us to delivering on what we see. Otherwise, if the people, if the person does not realize that the state in which they are is not the best state, is not the ideal state, that they themselves have a stake to change that state, then we will be running a futile race. And we'll definitely collapse on our own. So we need to get these people on board. And that is the approach we are taking.
What are some of the tools? Will you share that with
us? Some of the tools we're using is one, getting into the community, understanding what the challenges are, understanding what the causes are of those challenges, and then using their local initiatives to solve challenges. Now, for us, what we do is just a catalyst, provide the information through dialogues, through meetings, through capacity development, through skills, through mentorship. And we use their own community structures. We use their own, but give them the right information at the right time.
And what are you doing with boys and men?
About 5 years ago, we started working with boys. We started first with the boys at high school, because we used to work with girls in universities and would only collect girls and bring them together, talk to them, and they would go. But the girls would come back with the same challenges. We realized that we were doing something that was not helping. So we started getting the boys, the younger men in the universities on board. And these boys have now become champions on gender in the universities.
He for she.
He for she. Then in the communities, we work with communities, but also important, we work with local leaders. What in Uganda we call them local councillors. We have a 70-30%, 70 women, 30% men. Get them on board. Why are we doing that? Because when we used to work with the women leaders in local council, we'd give them all the skills, all the information, all the tactics, and then they would go encounter the same challenges or maybe succeed very minimally. Then we realized there was a roadblock. We got the men on board. Now, the men, when the women raise the issues in parliament or in council, they become the supporters of these women. That has also helped us, working with leaders, legislators at the national and the local level, and getting men on board. Then in the communities, we know that most of our community structures are led by men. So we target those institutions. We have separate meetings with the men, we have separate meetings with the women, then at one point we bring them together when we feel there is a certain level of appreciation and understanding.
What about high school, at the high school level?
High school as an organization, we've targeted a few, but I know there are sister organizations who are concentrating on that.
Now, I have another question for you. You're here at the CSW, and you've been coming here for the past three years.
Yeah.
And have you gone into the side events, just hear what your government is saying and see if it collaborates, how it differs or anything like that, and arm yourself to go back home to address XYZ issue, because this is why we're here, right?
I have had the opportunity to come to CSW both on as a government delegate and as now as civil society. The two times I've come as government delegate, I've been able to sit within the minister and also be able to look at some of the language that she uses, and I've been part of that, you know, engagement. And for the two times I've been there, we as a country have been honest how far we've been able to go, and also acknowledging some of the challenges we have. That is on the government side. Unfortunately, this year, I've not been able to attend any government event.
But what I find interesting, though, and quite like, is what you said. You sit with the ministry and she, and listen to what she says, look at the language and all that. Tell us about the proportion of government in terms of gender equality in your parliament, because Uganda has been praised many years and is a shining example to countries like Rwanda, and Sierra Leone was trying to emulate it.
In the last parliament, we had women composing 34%. We are one of the countries that is really doing well in terms of numbers. And that is replicated even at the lower levels in local councils. So, and of course, you know, in Uganda we have what we call the affirmative action. So I don't know how I can say it, but we have administration in districts. So we have 112 districts. And for every district, there is already one woman representative. That is mandatory. Then besides that, then we have the other interest groups. We have with people with disabilities. We have youth. We have workers. We have the army. And all that, at least a third must be women. So at least one must be a woman.
But you want to bring that up to a 50-50 parity?
Yes, we want parity. That's our last recommendation. We're asking for parity. We've just had elections last month. And the numbers, I don't think it's still staggering, between 34, 30, at most 36. So we're not making any headways. Because the majority of the women who come to parliament are coming through affirmative action. So you just imagine if tomorrow we said we're not having affirmative action, I don't think we'll have more than 30 women in parliament out of the 400.
Is it that they're reluctant to run for office, or is it that in the colleges, universities, they're not encouraged?
No. Actually, the number of women who are running for elective positions is quite high. But there are a number of things that affect their participation. Issues of, first of all, if you're running on what we call the direct seat, where you're running with a male counterpart, then you, as a woman, you'll be told you have a space in the affirmative action seat. Why are you coming here?
Excuse me?
Yeah. Why are you coming here? So it is expected in people's minds that women should only go for the affirmative action seat.
But you have to do something about that.
And that is what we are fighting to do, changing people's mind that while the affirmative action seat is there, this other seat is open for women as well.
Well, what's the situation with DV? That's going to be my last question for you about domestic violence and intimate partner violence.
Domestic violence, We started advocacy around violence against women way back in 1996. And we had a law passed in 2010. We didn't have a law on domestic violence. So we had to start profiling, you know, violence against women, making people understand. Because initially, violence against women or beating your wife was culturally acceptable. It was socially tolerated. So we had to raise this consciousness for a very long time, from that time up to 2010. That's when we have the Domestic Violence Act passed. Now, while the law has been passed, we still have a lot of challenges. Not many people know about this law. There are very limited efforts to ensure that the the duty bearers understand the law, the police, the law enforcement, the judiciary, and, you know, understand what this law is about, and they use it to, you know, provide justice. There is still very limited understanding within the community that there is a law, and that has to stop. And that job, unfortunately, it is civil society doing it, and with very limited resources, very limited outreach, we're still struggling for people to understand that. Domestic violence still remains very high in Uganda. It's above 60%. Yeah, it's very high. And unfortunately, some of the violence that occurs is tolerated as a sign of love. If you don't beat your wife, you don't love her.
All over the world. In Tanzania, there is a... They began by the government this whole thing about training the police, mm-hmm. and as an institution, within each police station, there is the gender component, the mm-hmm. gender desk. Mm-hmm. Is that true in Uganda?
Yes, it's true. And actually, UONET took the initiative to work with police in the mid-90s and late 90s. And through that, we now have the Family and Child Protection Unit in the police as a unit. So every police unit or station has a child and family protection unit.
You have an oversight body to make sure that the police is...
Unfortunately, not really, but they are within the justice, law and order sector. But we work with the police. The training you're talking about, we provide training for the police on gender, on DVA. We support the police on basic things to ensure that they provide access to women. We provide them with the police forms that you take, you know, the statement of a survivor on violence. We do that.
How is that going?
It's quite challenging because the demand is high. And as an NGO, we can't sustain it.
And they are, like, very receptive and like...
They are very receptive, especially when you're working at the community levels. They are very receptive because you really meet their needs.
Rita Akiro-Lakor.
Yes.
Executive Director of Uganda Women's Network, mm-hmm. UONET. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for taking this time to chat with me a little about your work and the work of your organization, mm-hmm. and keep going.
Thank you.
Keep on keeping on.
Thank you. And I really love to share our experiences, and I want to make my contribution.
Thank you very much.
Sheila Dallas Katzman is president of the U.S. chapter of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television. She conducted that interview during the 63rd annual session of the UN Commission on the Status of Women in New York. IAWRT will host a session titled Speaking Truth to Power at the virtual UNCSW in 2021. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our website, wingsradio.org/WordPress. We also have a daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent paper, The Unilateral Gift Economy Conjecture, appears in the American Review of Political Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, and this is the Women's International News Gathering Service.